Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2021.
The topic today is stocks and their valuation. Now, leading into that, I'm going to go back a little bit to the capital asset pricing model and talk a little about that, because it plays into what we're doing here in this series, in this lecture today and on Wednesday. A caution on this. Today is pretty lightweight, just terminology and some old material. And then on Wednesday, there's a math part. The math part can be difficult, but I've got a way to do it on your TI-83 calculator, either the real version or the emulator, that makes it incredibly easy, but you have to follow the steps. It's not supposed to be done with a TI-83, but it does work. It works exactly the way you would want it to. So keep that in mind, that there's going to be some math in here, and it does look a little complicated, but it isn't if you just follow the technical routine I'm going to show you. But before I do that, let me take a look at the numbers just briefly. There you go. This was a very typical day, except backwards. Now, in this day, the largest 30 companies of the world actually didn't do very well. It was just like a piddly day for them. And then the S&P 500 was up about a third of a percent, not much, but enough. And then the NASDAQ did a darn decent day. So in other words, whatever news there was that was going on out there was principally benefiting companies as they were smaller. That's a little bit opposite of what usually happens. But explaining this, it could just be random. But when you see patterns, there's something else going on here. What's going on? Hard to say. We do know, we did see the government issued the monthly manufacturing level, and we slipped for the second straight month, indicating that we are beginning to lose the momentum of a recovery, and we may be sliding toward a recession. That's bad because, of course, that means that you're going to go out there into a really difficult situation down the road, especially in a year or two, when we've got stagnating economy and inflation at the same time. Over here, crude. Obviously, here we go again. As I said before, I called it at 75, and now the market's 90, and they're trying to get there. Once we get to 90 on a barrel of oil, I don't know, you're probably going to see, that'll probably get us to $4 a gallon, probably $8 a gallon if you're in Chicago, but the thing is, this is bad. You pay more for gas. What that does is that takes money away from other things you could do. And that reduces the economy's ability to grow. So as gas prices go up, they bleed strength off the economy. That's not good news. Why are they going up? It's inflation. It's clearly inflation expectations beginning to build in. But there's a good side to this. You don't like paying high prices for gas. And I'm sure you don't either. But there's the good side of this is the technological substitution effect. You see, when gas is cheap, why would I waste my time investing in very expensive new technologies that are inefficient, that I've got to spend a lot of money to make efficient? A gas-burning engine or a diesel engine can haul but across the road, monster loads. A diesel can pull just insane amounts of weight on a train. Why would I invest in wind turbines? Why would I invest in solar panels? Oh, those are very good. No, they're not. They are inefficient as hell. That's just the reality of it. But if you get gas up there to $200 a barrel, suddenly it's worth our while to get them good, fast. You see, if I can spend and get kilowatt hours that are expensive, admittedly, with wind turbines, but they have so much potential. And I just need the substitute, the gas, to get up there high enough so that it's worth my while to get these things to be relatively cheap as an alternative. Right now, you buy a car like a Tesla, you're a fool. I got to watch two guys pushing a lady in a Tesla toward an electric pump. That was just, I honked and waved. But they're really not that ready. Rivian, that's not ready. But if you get gas high enough, suddenly there will be the incentive to invest in those technologies. So, yeah, it's bad for us as individuals. And in the short run, it's very bad for the economy. But over the long run, as the price of hydrocarbons, as we call them, you've heard me use that, as the price of hydrocarbons goes up, well, that makes me a happy person because that will make the future for you better. When we get to the point, look, it's extreme. There is, the thing though is, even electric cars, they're using coal-fired power plants to do that. But they're also using nukes. Nukes are nasty. No matter how safe they make them, so we don't have another Three Mile Island or another Chernobyl, they're still nasty. But there is another nuclear technology coming. It is expensive AF right now, but man, once we get that going, we've solved the problem of energy. It's called fusion. We're still 20 years out, and it's just insanely expensive, but once we get it going, we've got little stars, literally little stars right here on Earth, wherever we want to build them. And the second benefit is that the plasma fields from those little stars, you can throw any junk you want into them, all the trash on Earth, and it'll just be brought back down to its atomic level. So it's awesome stuff coming, just some pain along the way. So when you see that crude oil price, you are the leaders. You don't see the immediate, you see the long haul. Okay, gold and silver, I walk away. Now bonds. The yield was up 6.5 basis points today. Make sure you can see that, 6.5 basis points. And that means that yield went up, so price went down. Price went down because there was a general movement of investors away from bonds. Why are bonds going up in yield? There's the expected inflation premium sneaking its dirty butt in there, and it's showing up. Interest rates are going to go up. The Fed is still printing money hand over fist, just cranking money out. The price of money is interest rates. The oversupply of money should drive interest rates down, keep them down, which is what the Fed has been doing since 2017 to try to keep a bad economy from going to hell. Now, the long run is happening. No matter how hard you try to keep interest rates down by keeping the real rate down, the expected inflation premium starts to come in and they go up. And I will, next week I think it is, I'm not sure if it's next week, I will tell you the story of what happened, the finance and the politics and finance and economics of what happened the last time in the 1960s and 70s. And you'll see what's going to happen this time. It's not history repeating itself. It's just history fulfilling its obligations to logic and reasoning. Now, anyway, yeah, London's just not having a good day. The Nikkei is, there's a lot of optimism over in Asia right now. But, man, you talk to the people personally, and they are jittery, just so jittery about China. Trying to play the bully over Taiwan, and then announcing its hypersonic, silly, not hypersonic, nuclear weapons. But yeah, there's a lot of nervousness. So the Nikkei is going up, though. So more power to them. Okay, enough of that. Let me get on with today's lecture. In the last lecture, I did this. This camera has been moving around from day to day, so I don't know exactly where it is right now. The capital asset pricing model. It says that the expected return to any stock or portfolio or project, the return we expect from it, is going to be the risk-free rate plus the beta of the stock, portfolio, or project times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. Although I don't usually push too much on proving this equation is an equilibrium condition, it's actually not hard at all. It's just a simple linear relationship that comes out to be the logical result of finance theory. It's not like showing, you see that's the silly signs that show E equals MC squared. Gee, I can write a fancy an equation. God, if you saw the math behind that thing, Lordy. But this is really simple. And this expected return is good for many things. Yeah. Say that again. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm going to here as I go through the first one. As a matter of fact, you, madam, could have just finished high school and gone to work at McDonald's. Or okay, Steak and Shake. Nah, not Chick-fil-A. Yes, Chick-fil-A. The pickle. But anyway, but you chose college instead. That's riskier because you're going to spend money. And there's no guarantee you're going to get a job. You could still end up being the assistant manager at a McDonald's in Gatlinburg. And on the weekends, you'd do side jobs as a male escort. I know, right? It's what we have to do, you know, me and you. But the thing, though, is that you didn't do that. You see, here's the thing is that you're taking risks here. Going to college. Now, if you'd gone to McDonald's to work, you would have made minimum wage, $21 an hour. I saw a sign, McDonald's, $21 an hour. So someone working at McDonald's is going to make what I make. Yeah, okay. FML. Anyway, you see this piece right here? This is called the market premium. And the whole name of it is the market premium for taking the risk of the market portfolio instead of a risk-free portfolio. You see, a risk-free portfolio will deliver a little bit of money to you. It's not a zero. I can invest in a treasury, pay $990, and in a year I get $1,000. That's a $10. That's the point there being that the risk-free rate is a positive number. It's not a big number. But if you invest in the market, you're taking a risk, and that's like the difference between what you're going to make probably about $60,000 a year when you get out of here. You? 30? 40? No. He'll be the genius. He'll make $200,000. You know, I know these kids that make ridiculous money. But anyway, instead of the, what, 20,000? So in other words, 60 minus 20, 40,000 is your premium for engaging the market instead of cowering in a risk-free investment. So in other words, this is the expected return to the market portfolio. That's one of those portfolios that's kind of theoretical. It's on the frontier of efficient investments. Remember that thing?
all of the portfolios that are underneath it, but there are theoretically portfolios that sit right on the curve. That would be one of those right on the curve. Now, by the way, this theories are not really very interesting unless you can use them. And we use this one all the time. So that means we actually have to have numbers here. And this one's the risk-free rate. So what I was going to say there was, there are services that take surveys of experts, professionals. I'm in one. It's got like 70 people in finance industry and academia. There are like dozens of these services, and each of them publishes every month or every a quarter what their poll of these experts says is the expected return to the market portfolio. Like in this last one, I participated in. And there are 70 or maybe a little fewer or less, because I guess a couple of them died recently, but almost 70 people. I put in that my estimate was 8.0 for the annualized was 8.0 for that expected return to the market portfolio. The consensus across the 70 members or so was 8.4%. So I was a little on the bearish side on that, but not far off. What I think my service takes all of them and then throws out the highest and lowest two. So you don't get those real crazy types of people who think that the world is coming to an end, or people who think that the sky is going to open up with sunshine. So anyway, there are a lot of these services that you can get. Now, the Treasury, the risk-free rate, let me show you something here. Oh, mother's work is never done. Now, this is published every day. And I'll be showing you this again because this is the story of interest rates, the Treasury bills and the Treasury notes and the Treasury bonds. So you see right here, as of today, the 1 year is 0.11%. That's annualized. Now, that's obviously a really tough, that's 0.11%. That's not 1.1% or 11%. That's 0.11%. And it's even worse when you get down to the 1 month, which is 0.05%. So you can see how hard the Fed is trying to keep interest rates at the historically lowest levels you could imagine, and how much money the Fed has to print to cause that to happen, and how much inflation that is going to create for you and me to deal with in the next couple of years. It's going to be insane. And this does not, let me make sure I'm not giving you a political bias, though. This is not the current administration. This goes back to 2017 when the economy wanted to slip into a recession. The Fed was ready to let it happen until the president at that time threatened to fire the governors, the chairman of the Board of Governors of the Fed. No one had ever threatened that before. As a matter of fact, we're not even sure it could be done. But they buckled, and the governors just ran like a bunch of cowardly dogs and started printing money to keep the economy from falling down. And they, once you start, you can't stop. It's just like a good, that first taste of smack. After that, then every other taste you get through your arm is just going to be that much sweeter until it isn't, and then you're gone. How do I know that? Well, you just go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. 1 year. Now, this is the one that we usually would use for the Arcebel. That's in normal times, that'd be right like 1, 2%, 2.5%. So you're seeing something that is just historically bizarre. Now, a small side note.
this is how we've used the CAPM and how we get actual numbers out. And we've been doing this for many, many years. Decades. Almost, actually, scary. More than a half a century now, maybe. Okay. Now, oddly enough, I had an interaction with a couple of analysts a few years back. We were just talking about the CAPM. There are alternatives out there, and I'll mention one, but they're really, none of them have stood the test of time like that simple equation has. But we got to do a sort of a friendly argument. You always pulled the 1 year to put in for the R sub F. That's what we've always done. And they said, these two people I was at dinner with said, not anymore, we don't do it that way. We use a 7 year. And I said, what? Why would you do that? Because it's not risk-free anymore. Because the maturity premium, there'd be a 7 year maturity premium. That something that long, there's possibility of interest rate volatility. So that would not be a purely risk-free rate. It would have the maturity premium, which is part of the overall risk premium. I said, you wouldn't want to do that. And they said, think about it this way. This CAPM is used for valuing stocks, for valuing projects, for valuing portfolios. That's what we do. That's why we get that expected return number. If not one of those is a 1 year or a 1 month deal. Everything we use CAPM for is long term. So why wouldn't you use something that was acceptably longer, more like the lifetime holding of a stock or the life of a new project? And so, yeah, I get it. The 7 year, 1.43. I'm not going to do it because I'm an old bastard, but I do get their idea. Okay, so anyway, just leaving that there for a second. What this means is that in practice, I would say, well, let's say that it is, according to my group's consensus, the expected return to the market portfolio over the next year is 8.4%. Let's just say it. I really would like to use a more normal number there, something like 1.5%, but, you know. So now, let's say that we were interested in the beta. Let's say we've got a stock with a beta of 0.60. It's a safe stock. So the CAPM would say that the expected return to this stock would be 0.11% plus 0.6 times 8.4% less 0.11%. So if I pound that out, that would be 0.11 plus 0.6 times 8.4 minus 0.11. Notice, by the way, with the CAPM, you can use just plain old percentages because everything in there is a percentage except for the beta, which is just a weighting factor. Okay, so That would be the expected return to this portfolio. Is that going to be what it actually is? Oh, heck no. It's going to be, but that is where our central expectation would come in. And this is that was a huge advance for us in the 1960s, was to be able to have a way that was an equilibrium condition. In other words, this is like physics, where we get those equations in physics that have to be there. That's just how it works, kind of thing. Force equals mass times acceleration, those kinds of equations. Distance equals rate times time. They're just there. And so CAPM gave us this thing for finance. Now, I before I go too much further, I need to make two points. There have been competing models since CAPM. One that has come and gone, the book mentions it, is what's called the arbitrage pricing theory, APT. It says that the expected return would be this, but there would be a series of betas representing different dimensions of risk. Instead of a single beta risk, it would have different dimensions. So you'd have beta 1 times this, plus beta 2 times this, plus beta 3 times this. How much do you get out of it? It's never caught on because it never did give a much better predictive model. And that's what we care about. Can it predict? Can it do that job for us? So APT is out there, and you'll see it. Yeah. Oh, okay. I was going to say, don't ask me to prove APT. Now there's another one. I actually teach it, but it's not something I could teach at an undergraduate level. It's not really any better than this until it is. It's the one that is used by massive companies involved in insanely large projects that have multiple stages to them. It's based upon the options pricing model, OPM, and it's being used for everything. The first time it was used was in 1995 by Boeing, when it was analyzing whether or not to go ahead with the Dreamliner. And then it's been used since then, and now it's being used as we're mapping out the steps and whether it's a go or no-go for things like space colonies, hotels, entertainment, mining operations on the moon and asteroids. It's scale on that level that the alternative is. So you're never going to have to worry about it in your lifetimes, I hope. I hope I don't ever have to see it in real life again either. Okay, now, the other thing is, interestingly enough, this was very quickly embraced in academia because we saw that it was an equilibrium model. It's physics. It's not debatable kind of thing. But getting it out into practice with anything that's new is going to be hard. That's why folks like you, you're going to see things that I teach here that you're not going to be able to use at first in your companies because they'll use older methods. And I'm even going to show you some of those older methods, how silly they are, and how they're still being used. It'll drive you crazy sometimes because we prepare you for the future of that of those companies. When you get out there, you're going to see the past, probably. But in that regard, for a long, long time, for nearly a century or more, states have regulated utility companies. They say to a utility, an electric company, okay, you're allowed to have a monopoly. You're the only one we will allow to sell electricity to people in this area. In exchange for that, you must submit to our regulatory authority. We'll tell you how much you can charge per kilowatt hour or per cubic foot of natural gas or whatever, or for cable TV access. We'll tell you. And then in exchange, you get the monopoly rights to everything. It worked out to control the companies and all that. And it was oftentimes these utility regulators were nothing, had turned into kind of like rubber stamps for these because utility companies paid them under the table or paid for their campaigns or paid them extra moolah on the side. So the utility companies were kind of like whatever you want. But then utility companies started getting a little bit more cracking down because consumers were just screaming about the cost of utility, their utilities, their electricity. Now, I think the first case happened on the East Coast. And I almost want to say the state, but I won't. The utility company goes every year for its approval for a rate increase. So an electric company went to the utility regulators of the state and said, we should like this increase in the rates we're charging per kilowatt hour. It was a big increase. And the reason they wanted this was because they said the fair market return to our stockholders is 16.5%, something like that. These utility regulators, they were like not much older than you coming out of the universities, the heavies like this, and they were being taught CAPM. I said, well, let's find the beta. Well, the betas of those utility companies were like 0.2, 0.4. They're safe AF because they're monopolies. There's no competition. And so and then they looked at the expected return to the market portfolio, looked at the risk-free rate, calculated it out by hand back then. They had calculators. But they said, you're fair market return, according to the capital asset pricing model, is about 5%. It's not any of this crap with 16.5%. Don't give us that. CAPM is saying it's 5%. Well, the utility company screamed and cried and threw itself around and martyred them and went to court. And the judge, being a dumbass imbecile, said that CAPM is just airhead, academic airhead stuff. Give them their 16.5% and pay for their legal fees. So that's what happens when you try to move something forward. Courts are notorious for being way behind the times and the very stupid when it comes to finance. And I'll tell you a story about that with the Supreme Court of the United States in a few weeks. You'll see just how staggering that idiocy is. It was only in the 1980s that the CAPM was so widely known that courts could not ignore it anymore. And they started saying regulators could use that to determine the fair market return to utility companies and therefore their rate hike amounts. Got through that. But there's a cautionary tale. You don't ever want to embrace something just because it's new and fancy. But at the same time, if it's based on hardcore science, I mean, you got to let go of the old at some point. Let me mention something here. And I'm going to get really off in another field. I warn you, I'll come back as fast as I can. It has to do with this efficient frontier of investments. Along this frontier, these are world market portfolios. You'll never be able to get to them. They're sort of like the speed of light. You can't quite get there. We're absolute zero. You can't quite get there. But we can get awfully close. And we know what it looks like there on the frontier. These would be every company in the world in the portfolio. And each company in the portfolio would contribute its comparative relative value in the world economy. So in other words, there would be billions of companies in there, and each one would have a tiny amount, except for some of the giants of the earth. So it's obviously, it's not going to be too theoretically possible to do it. But like I said, if you take my investments course, I'll show you some ways we can get really, really close to the frontier. Well, anyway, this is the place. There's no investments above this, nothing but within here. It's an envelope. However, we are always trying to find a way around an envelope. You try to push against an envelope, it'll smack you around. But we're always trying to find ways around it, no matter what we look at. In physics, I mentioned the speed of light. We can't go at the speed of light. We can't go faster than the speed of light. But there's a way we can get around it. Because they were used, the term was used more than a half century ago, we call them warp drives. And there are several that are definitely, we can do it. They're very expensive, and we got to make them a hell of a lot more efficient. But we can do it. We can go around an envelope. We can break it. The same is true with this frontier. I know for a fact that I can buy a zero-risk portfolio of treasury bills. That's not on the frontier. It's outside of the frontier. But I also know that at least theoretically I could buy a market portfolio. And if I can buy either of these, then I could buy any linear combination of those. Kind of a weird thing, but I mean, I could buy half spiders, half treasuries, and I'd be up here instead of down here. Let me say that again. I could buy half spiders, S&P 500 portfolios, and half treasury bills, and I would be on this line, and I would earn this return instead of this return. I can break the envelope. I can jump it. But I'd always have to combine treasuries with market portfolios. Now, you're saying, well, how would you get out here? Well, what I would do is, in this case, I would borrow and buy additional leverage on the market portfolio, and I could get to any risk-return level I wanted. Whatever. See, that makes for something terribly boring, though, because that means that really, if you want to be a responsible investor, you should be doing nothing but combining, buying or borrowing on risk-free treasuries and buying a spider. That's really how you jump the efficient frontier. Anything else you would do, you're going to be down here somewhere. This is the same thing that's happening with the conceptualizations of breaking the speed of light. We're not going to do it. We're going to fold time. We're going to bend it. And then we can slide through. But you're not going to just be able to go anywhere and willy-nilly wee. You will go along warp vectors across the universe. We can do it. But we will travel along lines. Just like in disciplined finance, we don't just go anywhere because all we're going to do is be back here in this reality. It's only if we do it with the discipline of treasuries and market portfolios that we can actually get past it up here. Well, I can do whatever I want. Barney told me that. No, you can't. No, you can't. We can do it, but we have to do it the right way. You can't just wish for things. But what this brings us down to is, let me bring this up to you. You see this linear vector here? It's mostly just for illustration purposes, to show you how you break the envelope, how you jump it. We call this thing the capital market line. That's an unfortunate term. The capital market line let me tell you something. You see, this capital market line's behavior would depend upon the risk-free rate. So if the Fed were to raise the risk-free rate, that would tip this. It would always have to find a tangent world market portfolio, but it would be swinging through time. It would not be a fixed object. But wherever it was, wherever this world market portfolio is, there would be a sigma associated with it. That would be an important sigma because it would be a market portfolio. There would be no diversifiable risk in it because it would be everything in the world. If I were to graph the capital asset pricing model, it's nothing but a stupid little linear equation. It's literally a, let me get this right, y equals mx plus b. It's, again, y equals mx plus b. That's all it is. So in other words, it graphs as a straight line. Matter of fact, here's the independent variable, the beta. Here's the dependent variable. So you notice that the y-intercept is the risk-free rate, the b. Now, that would be a beta of zero. There's no risk and no risk-free rate, yeah, obviously. Now, out here, a 1.0 beta is the market portfolio. So there's its expected return. Now, you may remember from your dark past that 2 points define a line. There it is. That's the capital asset pricing model in a graphical form. Unfortunately, we call this line the securities market line. Which is unfortunate because the securities market line is the line of the capital asset pricing model. But the capital market line is not. Please write that down in your notes, and I'm going to telegraph my punch right now. I'm going to ask you, see if you can distinguish between a securities market line and a capital market line. Which is which? And which one is CAPM? CAPM is the securities market line. Don't ask me how that happened. I know it was actually in the original paper about CAPM. They called that the securities market line. They didn't mention the capital market line, even though that term had been used before that research. Anyway, there's that. It's nothing terribly complicated about the whole process at all. What was I thinking? Anyway, here's one last note. You see, you tell me any beta, and I can tell you what the expected return of the stock or the portfolio is. That's expected. Now, you see, that means that when you tell me, well, I made a return of 20%, I'll say, what was your beta? And if you can't tell me, I'll just say, sit down. If you tell me your beta, and the beta, let's say the beta was, you got, let's say, 12%, your beta was 1.2, you should have had, 1.5, you should have had a return up here, not down here. That's the whole thing about it, is the beta can tell you whether you're actually on the market or not. Now, there is a long, long history of believing that everyone or a lot of people have some magic in everything. And in stock investing, this belief that there are these ingenious investors, day traders are making bucks. No, they're not. Historically, it doesn't matter whether it's this past year or decades ago, day traders don't do as well as the market. They take insane risks that are not consistent with their capital market position. But once in a while, we do see someone. Your portfolio had a beta of 1.4, but your return was up here. You beat the market. Now, the market is down here. Don't think that's what it means. Beating the market means that you are above the capital market line. You see that distance there? Let's say the capital market line says you should have made 12% and you made 13.5%. We have a name for that. That distance right there is called Jensen's alpha. Jensen's alpha. A positive Jensen's alpha means you really did beat the market. But you would be surprised
When I do portfolios with students in other classes, I have groups, they try their best to beat. I tell them, look, if you get a positive Jensen's alpha that's larger than 1%, I don't care what risk your portfolio was. If you get a Jensen's alpha above 1%, you get an A, just automatically. No matter how stupid your investment would be considered, you know, if you get an alpha that Jensen's that's positive, I'm not going to argue with it. So very rarely does it happen. Well, it does, but it's really small amounts. Although this last time I had two different groups to freaking nail. Jensen's alpha for one was like, was it like 5.5% or something like that? And the other one was like 1% or so. Not bad. Most of them were Jensen's alphas that were slightly negative. You know, whatever. But the point there is that don't try to prove to me that you're impressive with your investing until you tell me what your risk was. And then I can tell you what you should have made. And if you don't make that, or if you don't make that, well, actually, you're not just a crummy investor. You don't touch any money that's anywhere near me or under my advisement because you don't understand. You took risk, and I don't care what you believe about theory and what your opinion is about it. This is how it works. And so this is something that we'll go into in a little more detail on Wednesday. Right now, I want you to get ready to take that quiz. It should be opening up.